Good morning. The Tribal Affairs Committee will now come to order. The time is 8:02 a.m. Tuesday, January 27th, 2026 in Capitol Room 106. Members present are, from my left to right, Representative Freer, Representative Story, Representative Carrick, Representative Underwood, and myself, Chair Dybert. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And a quick reminder to please silence your cell phones. I would like to thank Jordan Nicholson, the Tribal Affairs Secretary from Records, and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Thank you so much. I would also like to recognize Almaria Alcantara from my office, who is our committee aide for the Tribal Affairs Committee, and for all of her hard work getting us going for the session. If there's anything you need from her during our committee meetings, please signal for her attention, and she will be happy to assist. And let the record reflect that we have been joined by Representative Schwanke at 8:03. Good morning. Before we begin, I would like to thank you for joining the committee this session. Oops, I'm ahead of myself. Even though we have two items on the agenda today, let me start that again. We have two items on the agenda today. First, we will have a presentation on the Alaska Native Tribal Education Consortium. After that, we will have a presentation from Ilisagvik College. In respect to both presenters, I will be having a hard stop at 9:20 for the first presentation to allow time for our second presenters. And with that, I would also like to welcome Representative Ruffridge to House Tribal Affairs. Good morning. He joined us at 8:04. And thank you for joining the committee this session. This is Representative Ruffridge's first meeting with us. Thank you, even though we don't want to be too hard on you. We did break up the all-female committee, but we're very happy to have you. And
I just noticed.
Thanks, Justin.
Yeah. We can change that.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm looking forward to discussions with you and the committee members on just things that our tribes face here in the state of Alaska. So starting the presentation off will be Dr. Joel Isaac, Tle Ka Yes, and Misha Jackson, Chukunge Tla, and Sonia Klan. If you all could please come up to the table and state your name and title for the record before you begin. I ask that each presenter does the same as they start their section to keep track who is speaking throughout the hearing. Anabasi, thank you.
For the record, then Inish Iji Lakayis, Kanaitse Indian Tribe Ragatnu, a State of Alaska Compacting Consultant. So for the record, my name is Joel Isaac. I work for Kanaitse Indian Tribe as the Director for Language and Culture, and I also work for the Department of Education as a contractor for compacting. So that the two, ANTEC and STEC, are both acronyms. They both have tribal in them. They both have a C word that's in them. So if there's any confusion, I am happy to clarify. Today is about the consortium primarily. So if compacting questions come up, we can field them, but it's going to be about the consortium. And then I'll turn it over to Misha to introduce herself for the record.
For the record, Misha Jackson, Chukungi Kla Yuchat Duasak. I am Tlingit. I work for Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska as the Tribal Education Liaison. I also serve as an at-large representative for the National Indian Education Association. I'm going into my second year of a four-year term, and I also participate in the Tribal Education Department's National Assembly.
And for the record, is that working? Yeah, okay. Sonia Scan from Ketchikan Indian Community. I am the Education and Training Director, and I also am the Alaska rep for NIEA, National Indian Education Association, and just thank you for allowing us this time this morning.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here. And go ahead and begin.
All right. Sounds good. For the record, Joel Isaac. And this is just a brief agenda for today. We're going to do our introductions, and it's going to segue through tribal sovereignty background, what the Alaska Native Tribal Education Consortium, the acronym being ANTEC. So you're going to hear that and see that a lot throughout the presentation, and then the formation of that, and then an overview, and also for how the membership is conducted, and then how individuals or organizations would be able to join. So that's the overall agenda today. There are three of us here that have been the co-facilitators of forming ANTEC, but also with us in the room we have our tribal partners who have been part of the work as well. So we have Maddie with King Island Community, and Carl with Kinnick Tribe, and Mark with the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope. And so I just want to recognize them. And then also there's been about 80 individuals who have been on Zoom meetings and in person to form this. So I just want to, I'm not going to go through all 80 individuals, but just want to do the shout out to those who've been making this a reality. So we're on slide three. Just the beginning, if it's through the chair or to the chair, I'm going to do kind of the mission vision overview. And then may pause for questions in different chunks if that was, if what you'd like, or I can hold till the end, whichever you'd prefer.
I guess if the committee has a question, I'll keep track of time because we have till 9:20. We'll see how many questions come up, and if not, we might have to skip to the end.
Sounds good. All right, Joel Isaac for the record. Jumping back into slide three with the mission statement. The mission of ANTEC is to uphold, advance tribal sovereignty in education by empowering tribes to collaborate, coordinate, and advocate on matters affecting the success of Alaska's Native students, families, and communities. So really, the Tribal Education Consortium is very tribal-focused, which is there in the name, also in our mission. However, we know that Alaska Native students are not the only students in our state, and tribes are not the only organizations that care about kids, and so it really is about the success of all students and making access for, while it is tribal-focused and Alaska Native pedagogy is focused, it does impact and benefit all students and the existing system, and you'll see that throughout the presentation. So going on to the next slide, slide four, we have the vision. It's a unified and sovereign Alaska Native educational voice that drives transformative, culturally aligned systems of education from early childhood through post-secondary, rooted in indigenous knowledge, languages, and governance. This committee has done work on Alaska Native languages. We appreciate that. You see that would make sense in our education. That's one of the vision statements includes languages so that there's space for everybody. And then again, back to that tribal governance piece is one of the main visions for the consortium. And then our purpose is to amplify tribal voice in state, federal, and intertribal education policy discussions. There are 229 federally recognized tribes in the state of Alaska. There's the state of Alaska. We have school districts. We have state education agencies. There's tribal education agencies. There's school support organizations. So it's really about how do we amplify the tribal voice in those various systems. But I think one of the exciting things for this is that intertribal. One of the things that came up in House Tribal Affairs last session when we were doing the compacting conversation was how do tribes work together? And so this is one of the ways that tribes come together as governments is through entities like this that form, because it can be very difficult to get 229 governments to work together. And how do we not work in conflict? How do we resolve conflict? How do we amplify our voice and the resources that we have to not duplicate services or amplify the things that are working well? The second item, advocating for direct access to funding, data, and decision-making authority for tribal education. And if my co-presenters want to add anything to this slide, they're great at talking about this item. But it's one of the things that tribes don't have because of the Stevens rider at the congressional level is the Bureau of Indian Affairs funding coming into our state. And you may hear tribes come to your offices or anyone who's listening's offices and say, we need funding for education. And it's a federal piece with the BIA and that whole complex legal conundrum is one of the things that frequently comes up. And so that's a discussion that is kind of a perennial discussion with tribes. And then the data, we had just talked about, our students, our tribal citizens, are in our current public education system by and large. And what tribes are missing is the data to be able to track how are our students doing. FERPA often gets used against tribes to have access for their citizens, even though it's federally protected under Title VI, which is there's federal protections for that. So that often, this is one of the things that come up in that decision making. We often have to go to DC and then get our federal delegates to be like, this is the law we wrote, go tell the school district. And then the school district is like, we didn't know that law changed 10 years ago. And so it doesn't always have to be combative, but often the information that's happening in DC does not trickle down to every school district, which is a tall order. So that's one of the ways the consortium helping with that information flow.
I just want to say that this is Sonia, for the record, Sonia Scan, and through the chair, thank you. I just wanted to add that the direct access to the curriculum and all of those different things, we don't have one place to go right now. People are going, okay, I live here, so I can go here, and I can go there, and I can do this. This would enable one place to be a storehouse for curriculum, for all of those things, for all schools, for all LEAs, for all, not just for the tribes. But this would help with bringing in those components into the districts that are looking for them and need them. And this is a great way to do it, because I know as a tribe, we get a lot of phone calls to come into the school to teach certain things. This would give that ability to have a set curriculum that is used area-wide.
So, Joel Isaac, for the record, the last item on this slide, coordinating regional and statewide advocacy to improve educational outcome for Alaska Native students. I think that one kind of speaks for itself, but it's about improving the educational outcomes. Our goal is our kids. And you'll see that tribes don't own the traditional value of caring for children, but you will see that many tribes on the wall in practice. Children, youth, elders are considered a very strong benefit to society. They are an added value, not a pulling away from in any way. So that's one of the things that just looking at how does that traditional value in action look in our state, and that's one of the goals or the purposes of the consortium.
Through the chair, Misha Jackson, I would just add, there are models for this that already exist. So part of that is the Tribal Education Department National Assembly that myself and Mark both participate on a regular basis. Over in Virginia, there is also a Tribal Education Consortium that they've put together. And especially during the past year or so, you have seen different regional sets of tribes coming together to share information, advocacy, sign-on letters, et cetera, that have been going on that, passionately. And so this is a model probably we've been working on since we started negotiations, and it was clear that this was a gap and a need. I'd say just to give a quick example of the history of Alaska Native education, because that's the one thing I can bring to this is this did exist in some shape or form, but it was always grant funded, right? So there was the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative back in 1995 that was funded by the National Science Foundation. I think it was in partnership with AFN. And they basically helped create this statewide group that would work together and then break off into regions. So a lot of the cultural curriculum that you guys see to this day that has those historical roots from that huge grant, but once those stopped and the money stops coming through, only certain regions maintained those groups of education pockets, right? And then you can see how that played out over the next 20 years. And so we did have one in Southeast Alaska, which played an instrumental role, but it did eventually kind of fizzle out over time without that extra funding. And so this is really designed out of what the gaps we saw during negotiations, but also knowing that this has already existed. This is what helped push through the Alaska Cultural Standards. And so being able to play that role again and advocate, as well as follow suit from a lot of different regions across the United States, it really is just a time to empower tribal voice and shared experiences, since a lot of you guys serve on the Education Committee. But we know there is a lot of turnover for teachers, superintendents, but there's also a lot of teacher for administrative staff. And so our experience is often who's in the seat that has the control of data, that has control of a school building, et cetera. And then we have to like reteach and relearn. And when that comes from just one tribe, sometimes there can be a lot of defensiveness and protectiveness, which is naturally inherent when it comes to children. But then it's on tribes to reteach everything, right? And it kind of turns into this system where it feels like you're constantly fighting for what you know exists just to get people to kind of catch up and understand what's out there. And so really that's how I envision what this is able to offer is all the other tribal education, the Alaska Native Corporations. We get a lot of university professors that are tribal citizens dedicated to this work, and being able to share with them like the laws, the regulations, the things that are going on in other places and share that space helps them as they start training new teachers, they start training new superintendents. And so the trickle down of the information is only going to enhance. And so we look forward to working with those other 80 people plus as we continue to move forward. So thank you.
For the record, Joel Isaac, we're going to go to slide 6. The purpose has, there's 6 purpose items. We're halfway through the purpose. Our number 4, outreach and engagement of Alaska tribes, tribally empowered organizations in Alaska education policy, advocacy, and transformative change. So one of the technical distinctions, and we're going to get more into the technical legal jargon as we go, because that's always the fun part. If you're like me, you enjoy that. But if you're not, then you can learn to enjoy it. The Alaska Native or the non-government organizations is one of the terms you might hear. So a corporation, like an ANCSA corporation or a village or regional corporation, is considered a non-government organization. And so they don't have the test for a tribe is, are you asked to waive sovereign immunity? And if you're not, and you're a native organization, then you'd be considered a non-government organization. That's, the simplest way to describe the difference between a tribal government and a non-government organization. So we'll see that throughout the presentation. The key piece is we want to make space for both. And that's, I think, really one of the exciting things about the consortium is this is a first to be able to make space for the tribal governments, the tribal non-government organizations, which includes the nonprofits, and our school district educational supports like the university system, et cetera. Number 2 on this slide, promoting collaboration and shared learning across tribal education departments. Sonia had spoken to this a little bit. There are what's called tribal education departments, or TEAs, Tribal Education Agencies, which is a federal definition. And so the goal is when not all tribes have an education department, and some do. And so we've had, since we've started the Zoom meetings in the spring, tribes reach out and say, how do we form ordinances, which are tribal laws? How do we create a tribal education department? The federal government occasionally has grants to do the development of a tribal education agency, but not always. And so that's one of the things the consortium, as more tribes join, are able to show this is an example of tribal education codes. You don't have to start from scratch. And then the next one, advancing the continuity of language, culture, and indigenous worldviews in education. And so we've kind of spoken to that one already, but this is one of the pieces that it can be very difficult with the turnover within a tribe, but the school district, to be able to know how do we keep the curriculum? How do we understand it? How do we keep adapting it and building it? If one tribe has the curriculum, another one doesn't, all those types of things, how do we do that continuity? And so where we maintain institutional knowledge and that expertise, even though people might be fluidly moving back and forth between systems. That's one of the gaps that we noticed during what Misha and Sonia were talking about during the state tribal education compact negotiations. A lot of the needs came up. And so that's one of the responses to the need of our state. Mm-hmm. On slide 7, we're going to jump into a little bit about the background. So ANTEC, the Alaska Native Tribal Education Consortium, legally is a tribally sanctioned organization. And to be a tribally sanctioned organization, you have to have sovereign immunity as a tribal government. And so where is this recognized in Western courts? This has been inherently embedded since time immemorial with tribes doing self-governance. But if we look back to before the U.S. was, when the U.S. was still a colony and when Great Britain or England was doing the colonization around the world, this is one of the things that King George III had his royal proclamation. And this is one of the key parts just to kind of position what was on paper versus what happened. Nations or tribes should not be molested and disturbed in the possession of such parts of our domains and territories as, not having been ceded to or purchased by us, are reserved to them as their hunting grounds. So some key pieces of that is the disturbed or molested parts that happened with colonization, which is this is one of those things about international law. And then one of the things you might also in this committee hear about ANCSA or ANILCA kind of has to do with those traditional hunting grounds and purchase and all those types of legal framework comes from the 1700s. And not all of the law in this proclamation or from the 1700s is still actively recognized by all the nations who signed off on it in the Treaty of Paris. But that is one of the things that just to kind of positionality, where does sovereignty, how is it recognized, where did it come from in Western courts? If we look at, so there's the international law. If we go to slide 8 and look at the tribal sovereignty in U.S. law, in 1787, there was the Northwest Ordinance, which I'm not going to read the whole piece here, but I'm going to start out with the beginning part. The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards Indians. Their lands and property shall never be taken from them without consent, and in their property, rights, and liberty, they shall never be invaded or disturbed unless in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress. And you'll see more in that quote, but a key piece of this one is Congress. Congress has what's called plenary discretion, or not discretion, that's Congress can make laws to impact Alaskan tribes across the country. They have plenary power. That's the word I was looking for. Sorry, it's two P's in a row. Plenary power. And that's where we start to see this in U.S. law is back in 1787, which is very early on for our country. On slide 9, we're going to go to the U.S. Constitution. So tribes are listed in the Commerce Clause. The Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce and foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So if you hear the question like, well, where does this authority for tribes really come from? These are some of the answers to that. And it's rooted legally in the United States Constitution, which is still legally active. You can go back to Britain and the colony, and like, oh, that's not quite legally active, but the Constitution is. And you see this in tax code, because tribes are treated as states for tax purposes, which is why tribes don't always have to have a 501c3 to accept donations, just as a practical example. On slide 10, we jump more into the recent time frame. So 1934, you see the Indian Reorganization Act. And this is where we start to see this was during what's known as the termination era in federal policy. So the goal was to eradicate tribes and native people across the country. And you'll see that this is where it started to do more of a further articulation in federal law for government-to-government relationships with tribes and the federal government. And then we jump to 1978. You have the Interior Department. And if you've heard of FAP, which is the Federal Acknowledgement Process, this is how you might ask the question, well, how do you become a federally recognized tribe? Because that's been brought up a lot in this committee over the years is federal recognition for tribes in Alaska. We don't have state-recognized tribes where other states in the lower 48 do. We have federally recognized tribes in Alaska, and this is the beginnings of that technical term. And then jumping to slide 11, 1994, and this is what's known as the List Act. And the way that a tribe becomes a federally recognized tribe by an act of Congress, by the administrative procedures under 25 CFR Part 83, or by decision of a United States court. So what you see is after 1994, there were more tribes that became tribes in Alaska. So the number of federally recognized tribes in Alaska is not static, nor is it static across the U.S. So that number does change. It doesn't change real quickly. You can imagine trying to go advocate to Congress. It could take 30 years to become a tribe, and that is a real number. And so that's just a little bit about like where the tribal sovereignty for ANTEC comes from and why we're set up the way that we did as a tribally sanctioned organization. It's with that sovereignty piece. If we jump to Alaska law on slide 12, in 2022, HB 123 was passed and signed into law, and this bill provided for state recognition of federally recognized tribes. So it did not create new tribes. It did not transfer any trust responsibility. It was the state saying federally recognized tribes exist, and we recognize that they exist. And this is the section of that bill, section 0115-100, and it just recognizes the unique relationship between tribes and the United States. And that is one of the things that's you've heard in this committee during we talked about education with compacting or other presentations, is tribes are governments. They're considered political subdivisions at the federal level. They're treated as states in various sections of federal law, which is why, for educational purposes, they're different than school districts, and why you hear tribes coming and saying, we want to engage with the state, we want to engage with the federal government, because under the U.S. Constitution, tribes are treated as states. So that's just some of those, maybe hopefully some of those through lines that you've heard in the committee, and also where, the again, the authority for the consortium comes from. Peter, you want to add to that? Okay. So that's some of the legal background. Now we're going to get to maybe some of the more interesting stuff about the consortium itself and how and why it formed. So there are three membership eligibility options for joining ANTEC, and this is on slide 14. So because the consortium is a tribally sanctioned organization, to maintain that, the voting membership, you have to be a federally recognized tribe in Alaska. However, we also have two other forms of membership, which are affiliate memberships, which are non-voting, which is members of eligible Alaska Native serving organizations. So that's like those tribal non-government organizations or nonprofits, and then non-voting affiliate members through local education agencies. And we're rounding out how to include some of that, like the university system, but the goal is like the public education system that's not Native or tribal based. And these three pieces are super important, because often what happens is when we being tribes go to D.C., there's, or to the legislature, it's the question about like, well, what do the corporations think, or what do the tribes think? And historically, the laws have been constructed to, I think the good intention from them is, how do you get the trust responsibility from the federal government to meet every Alaska Native human being? And there's so many different definitions of what that looks like, and the experiment of the corporations and the tribes in separating out land and money and governance created this quagmire for Alaska. And that can get used as a wedge to separate the tribes and Native families from each other, and powers and money, and let you put all of that in the mix, and then it often creates the fighting. And our goal for the consortium is to bring all those entities together and recognize there are limited resources. How do we make the best of them, and how do we put kids at the center? And that really is part of what's transformative about the consortium, is it's from not from a scarcity mindset, like this is mine, I have to fight for this. It's we are working and fighting for our kids, and we need to bring all of our pieces together. And what other thing we had early on in the conversations back in February of 2025 is, do we make space for the non-tribal voice in this organization? Because what we've experienced as tribes is there usually is not space for us in a lot of the big entities. We have to kind of claw our way in and then try and advocate for an advisory role that's kind of lower. And that we didn't want to replicate that. And so we spent about 9 months figuring out, like, how do we maintain sovereignty and the mission, vision, purpose, but still give access and working together? Because, again, our tribal youth are in our public school system. So if we create an artificial wall, that's an adult problem, and our kids feel the effects of it. So we didn't want to root an organization in division. We wanted to bring it together in unity.
Excuse me. We have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dybert, and so good to see everybody today. If you could help me, I have two questions. If you could just give a few examples of the Alaska Native serving entities, the non-affiliate ones, and then local education agencies or our school districts. But it'd be great just to have a few more names on that. And then when you say that they're non-voting, I know a lot of times tribes have been asked to be voting members or meeting with our state agencies is government to government. They should have a seat at the table. And so why are you making them non-voting when you would, when I see other tribal entities wanting to be government to government and having a seat at the table?
Janann, thank you for the question. Joel Isaac, for the record, through the chair to Representative Story. It's good to see you, and thank you for the questions. Some examples are we've had conversations with Bristol Bay Native Corporations Foundation. We've had conversations with Cook Inlet Tribal Council, which is the nonprofit arm of the Siri Corporation, which is an Alaska Native, or an ANCSA, Alaska Native Corporation. And so those are some of the like big regional corporations. And we've had some conversations with Chukachmute, which is over on the north of Kodiak on the Valdez side of the of Alaska, looking at how do oftentimes the tribes that are smaller, they will kind of defer through their foundations or through their corporations to help filter information and bring back to their councils what they need to be following. And so we've had the conversations around that where a single individual might be bringing multiple tribes, might choose that single individual to be at a meeting for them and then bring the information back to those tribes, which is, again, different than the NGOs. But what we're seeing is that some of the NGOs are serving as that communication network for the tribes. And if we were to have like no NGOs allowed, then it makes it hard for that information to disseminate to everybody. So those are that's three examples of them. We've had university, as Misha said, university faculty attend the meetings. We've had principals and superintendents attend the meetings, which those are obviously not tribal, but those are an examples of the other non-affiliate members. And then to your second question about the non-voting piece is that it comes back to that federal law component about how do you maintain your status as a tribally sanctioned organization. If you don't have tribal sovereignty, you don't have that tribal government and that federally recognized tribe status, the organization would no longer be incorporated under federal law legally if we allowed for not voting members who were not tribal governments. And so that's the why for that is legally that's because we're incorporated under federal law. A nonprofit could incorporate under state law or it could incorporate under federal law type, but we're looking at the tribal authority recognized by the federal government is what we're incorporating under. And there's two ways that tribally sanctioned organization can form. One is through resolutions where each tribe opts in through its government official voted resolution. The other is a tribal government can create tribal law and create its own legal code for how to create a tribal organization. ANTEC decided to go the everyone gives their own resolution because otherwise all the tribes are under one tribal government, and that's a hard sell to have everyone, all the tribes as governments choose to be under someone else's tribe. Mm-hmm. So this maintained individual tribal sovereignty mm-hmm. and voice, also the option to opt in. We're not mandating that everyone, every tribe join this. So that's the route we went and why we went that route. Mm-hmm. Do you want to add any examples? Okay.
Okay. Thank you. That was a very great answer to break it down because it's a very confusing subject. We have a question from Rep. Carrick and then one from Rep. Ruffridge.
Thank you so much for breaking it down. I am still just a little confused what an example of the non-voting affiliate for an Alaska Native serving entity is, and then an example or maybe a couple for the local education agencies. And I think you listed all of those in there, but I was just kind of trying to put, you know, a couple of examples under each of those headers. So could you maybe go over that just one more time?
Yes. Thank you for the question, Joel Isaac, for the record, through the chair to Representative Carrick. The non-government organizations or the tribal non-government organizations, Cook Inlet Tribal Council was one of the ones I gave, CITC, and another one is Bristol Bay Native Corporation, BBNC, and then Chugachmute. And I apologize, I'm not great with spelling, and it starts with a CH. And then I keep going with my muscle memory on my keyboard. Those are three examples that we've had meetings with or who have attended the meetings. We also have had conversations with Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. We've done outreach to them. This is not saying that they have committed, but that's the discussions that we've had with the CEOs of SHI and CITC. And some of the conversations have been very productive, and it's some of it we need to see more information. We need to see how this plays out. There's a lot of change happening federally. We want to see more as this progresses. So as something starts new, that list will expand, but that's where we've started. And then the local education agency, we've had principals, and I think it's Yukon Flats is one of the school districts where principal came to our in-person meeting, and that was one of the things we had to address, where we had a tribal-only meeting, and then people fly in, and we're like, we're not going to kick you out. But there may be discussions that we ask you to, either we're going to be in executive session, we need to step out for 5 minutes while we talk about something, but we didn't have to do that. And so throughout the meetings, we've had to kind of figure out how do we respectfully figure this out as we go. And the principal was also very respectful of that. We've had conversations briefly with the superintendent from NOAM at AASB's conference as well, because they're one of the compacting affected districts. And he's kind of explaining the difference between the consortium and a compact.
Thank you.
I would just add, through the chair, Misha Jackson, for the non-affiliate member local education agencies and universities, oftentimes it depends on the size of the district in terms of who would come. So we've gotten some that are tribal citizens that are teachers or work in administrative capacity in the local education agency, or we have non-tribal members that join as well. But oftentimes you'll see whoever is in charge, the title varies, but whoever's in charge of what's called the Title VI funding, which comes from the Office of Indian Education directly. We had a lot of those folks come in. I wish we had the list of all the different names that we could give you, but so we had a lot of those ones. In smaller schools, you will tend to see the superintendent or a principal come in, because then they handle all of that funding. I think especially over the past year, since that was questionable on the federal level or it felt threatened, that's where a lot of the involvement came in, and then the interest as well. So to paint the light of the LEAs, you get anything from a teacher to administrator to superintendent, that'll come.
Sonia Scan, through the chair. I also would like to say that the NGOs are tribal serving organizations, and so they serve the same members that the tribes do, and the tribes are sovereign, and the tribal serving organizations are not, which is the point that we were making, to be a part of that sovereignty, and underneath that sovereignty, we want to be under the tribes. It doesn't mean there's no voice, because we're all in the same boat, as it were. So I just wanted to make sure. It's like it would be a duplication of services if we were to have the entities and the tribes, because we're serving the same people. So it would be the same vote.
Thank you for that. We'll go ahead and go to Representative Ruffridge and Representative Burke, and then we should continue on. I saw there's many pages, so Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. First is, I think it seems like maybe ANTEC is relatively new. How many voting members from federally recognized tribes are currently in ANTEC?
Through the chair, Joel Isaac, for the record, to Representative Ruffridge. Currently, there's 8, and that represents, we were doing some paper napkin math because we don't have every tribe's active role number, but we're pushing close to 50,000 tribal citizens that are represented by those 8 tribes. And we've had other tribes who've attended meetings but have not put resolutions forward at this point. And so that's the part, the other part of your question. This is very new. The Constitution became active in December, and the fiscal agent component became active, it was last Friday. Mm-hmm. So this is, we are now able to accept money. The piece with this work is that tribal voice is leading it. So the tribes that were looking at forming it and the entities that chose to come were paying their own way and putting together the legal fees to be able to talk to attorneys about this. So this is not grant funded currently. They're, like, this is something that is grassroots built by the Tribal Voice and the Alaska Native serving entities that want to be part of this work. And so it is very, very fresh.
Second question, if I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Help me understand, because it's outside of my realm of expertise, like a really long way. What would be the relationship between the, I guess, what we all think would be the largest, you know, collection of tribal voices together, which would be the Federation of Natives? I thought there was an education component to AFN. What is your relationship with AFN? Maybe this is in addition to the education work that was happening within that organization. And it felt like potentially there was more tribal members within that organization. Is there a partnership there, I think, is essentially the basis of that question. And how has that, you know, worked to establish what this is doing?
Joel Isaac, for the record, for the Chair to Representative Ruffridge. I appreciate the question. That was one of the lists that I, or the entities that I forgot to mention when Representative Carrick asked the question. So we have been meeting with AFN to talk with them about what we're doing. We're not trying to create a competition, so we've invited them to meetings. We've met with them. We've been sharing our draft resolutions and the Constitution to form to kind of keep them up to speed on what the consortium's goals are, what we're advocating in Washington, D.C., the state level. And also when we had the face-to-face meeting in the spring, Kendra came from AFN to the meeting, and it was helpful being able to talk through, like, how do, like, what works with an entity that's as large as AFN for the tribes, the corporation voices, all of those pieces to kind of kick the tires on the considerations that were probably going through your head for, like, how would you do something this big and how does it start? And so we have had active and there's still ongoing conversations. We were facilitated the panel discussion at the AASB conference in the fall. And we were able to talk with him after that and just kind of bring him up to speed also. So it's about every other month we've been either meeting face-to-face or on the phone and then emailing back and forth. And then one of the other just kind of examples is AFN would be an NGO that would be eligible to be part of the consortium. And whether or not they choose to do that is like AFN's prerogative. And AFN, in those conversations, I'm not going to speak on very detailed for what they do, but they have an education committee and they advocate for education. And AFN also does much, like a lot more types of advocacy than just education. And so that's one of the differences is the consortium is really focused on the education arena exclusively and then has a broader there are like specific purposes that we talked about that narrows the focus, but it allows us to go across a broader spectrum of advocacy and deeper, which might be more difficult for an organization that's trying to do so many different types of advocacy. Is kind of how we're seeing that progress. And then one of those other things, like we're not trying, if they're doing the heavy lift in an area, we can be a supportive voice and we don't need to pick that up and vice versa, where it's like AFN supports what we're doing, then they might not have to do as much of the heavy lifting and we might do more of the heavy lifting.
Thank you.
All right, we will go to Representative Freer and the current time is 8:45, so we have about 30 minutes left, and it looks like about six more slides. Representative Freer.
Thank you, Chair Diver. Actually, Representative Ruffridge asked my question, so I'm good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Please continue, Dr. Joel Isaac.
Thank you for the record, Joel Isaac. Moving to slide 15, this is the how do you become a member, and we've talked a little bit about some of these slides, but we'll refresh them. Membership is made active by transmitting a signed resolution or a signed authorization of an eligible entity. So, for example, a tribal government is going to need a tribal resolution that government officially is requesting to join. What it looks like for the various NGOs, it might be different than a resolution. It might be, so we're figuring out what that looks like because each entity might have a board vote, and it might be a different legal mechanisms. But you'll see resolutions is the most common one is what we're experiencing. And then to maintain the tribal sanctioned legal status, only federally recognized tribal ANTEC memberships are voting members. However, all other members are eligible to be part of ANTEC and serve on committees, participate in meetings and ANTEC activities. So the way that ANTEC has functioned, it functions, we're developing working groups. So for example, a policy initiative might come forward and there's a working group that would form around that. They make a recommendation if there needs to be for a vote. That vote would go to the tribal voting membership, but really the structure of how it's vetted and what gets brought to the voting table is made through those working groups. And we were specific with the term working group because as I just discussed, there's not funding for this right now. So the how you get to the table is that you work. That's what happens. If you want to be active, then you're doing the work. And we are actively looking for funding to help with staff and things like that. But really, it's an open invitation. And what that work is, it looks different for each member, but it's that kind of that traditional value of how does everyone contribute? And that contribution might not look the exact same way. And so like I was talking earlier, a child's contribution to society might look different than an elder's contribution to society, but they're both actively contributing. And one of those, the base contributions is you show up to the meetings. And that's how we are getting most of the information out, and you follow your email. So like that's the baseline. Everyone has to do that to be actively involved. And then we go from there. Moving on to slide 16, these are the formation protocols. So the presentation, we kind of talked with the legal status and how the legal foundation for how it formed, how you become a member of it. And then as we kind of end the presentation, there is space for some more questions, but looking at like what was the protocols we used to do something like this that's never been done in our state. There's also a similar thing that's happening right now in the Plains area of our country, and they're grappling with moving, like working across state boundaries and across like country, like between Canada and the U.S. And we haven't quite had the Canada conversation with our Gwich'in and other Alaska Native Tlingit relatives who live in Canada or go back and forth. But that's one of the things tribes, there's these boundaries that were foisted upon us that we are working as tribal governments. Essentially, it's international exchange that we're doing. So just as far as some of the context. So looking at being respectful of all participants and all communications, we all try and listen, understand, and not react. It's okay to disagree, but not blame, shame, or attack ourselves or others. This is one of the other things that we have in a lot of our foundation documents on item 2 is there are the federally recognized tribes, they exist as sovereign governments, and the tribal sovereignty of these tribes shall not be diminished nor impaired. So that's one of the questions that's come from the tribes is it's like, if we join this, are we diminishing our tribal authority or our voice? And so we have this explicitly listed as one of our things that we shall not do that. And it provides that test, if you will, like in a legal standpoint. Like if we're starting to do that and we have this statement, you can test the decision or the process against, is this diminishing tribal voice? And it allows, it kind of depersonalizes it and puts it back to the question. There is a commitment to demonstrate honor and respect of Alaska Native culture and self-governance and education. Slide 17. We will do what we can, and at least for now, let go of what we can't. There is a lot of things that could be addressed in education, as all of you are aware of. And the consortium starting out this last year and going into this year, we often, when we're spitballing at our face-to-face meeting, we had lots of big sticky notes on the walls, and they were filled with everything the consortium could do. It's like, okay, well, now we know like what everyone's looking for, and how do we start, and how do we eventually get there? And so just recognizing we have to go slow and start small to go further and grow. Working group participants will work in good faith and the spirit of collaboration. And then part of that respect of that and that collaboration is that resources, both financial and human, are limited. Duplication, replication of the existing educational system should be avoided. And that's part of like we're not trying to create the exact same thing that exists already. And we make that very clear with our meetings. And then on slide 18, one of our acknowledgments that we have in our meetings is that students have the right to be educated within their own community and through their culture and language. And just acknowledging the horrific effect of forced removal are still felt by Alaskans and especially the Alaska Native community. And this is the boarding school era especially. We still very actively feel the effects of that. And so just acknowledging that that affects our work. And then all students and communities benefit from having an understanding and knowledge of Alaska Native peoples, cultures, ways of knowing, and language. This is a benefit and a strength unique to Alaska.
Through the chair, Misha Jackson, I think Dr. Isaac undersells his ability right here in facilitating groups, but these acknowledgments allow everybody to come to the table in the same space and with that idea of being future focused and moving forward. And so we have all shared, and I can look at the folks behind us as well, we've all shared space with a lot of different educators, Alaska Natives. And this is probably the hardest part, is getting everybody to that shared understanding. So this is usually how we start pretty much every meeting, is these acknowledgments that, yes, we acknowledge that these things have happened. These are the goals. These are the expectations. And this is what we're working towards, so that we can start from there. And it helps those conversations move forward. But it's also that part of that healing and that voice and acknowledgement in Alaska Native culture, I think, is probably one of the most universal values that we have, just acknowledging people personally, acknowledging, spirituality, etc. And so being able to bring that and ground that in the room has been very beneficial, and it allows us to go from like talking around ideas to actually doing the work. And I think that's what allows us to set that working group model forward. So I just wanted to speak light to these ones, because this is definitely a practice that is beneficial for working with Alaska Native and Alaska Native tribes.
Joel Isaac, for the record. I think the other thing, as like just kind of reflecting what Misha just said, is in the meetings, we had discussions around the boarding school trauma, and we did create space for it. It wasn't a long time period, because it's an acknowledgement that everyone in the room lives this. And as we have non-Native people joining the meetings, it starts to create a space where they can see how this also is affecting them, even though they're not Alaska Native, or it's affecting their school, even though it's not a tribal school. And one of the things that I think is the benefit and strength unique to Alaska is that by having the tribes lead this formation of a consortium, it's healing focused, and the tribes are helping leading that healing work that our entire state needs. And that's one of the things we could see as like through lines across the sticky notes in that meeting, is this is affecting every single person in our state. We all are impacted by education in one way or another. And as we see little pockets of that pop up, sometimes it can be really hard to talk about. Other times it's really beneficial. It's fun to spend time outside. You learn a lot by hunting and fishing and spending time with family. Alaska Native people don't exclusively own the right of family value, but it benefits everybody. But what has happened with the forced removal of kids is that our Alaska Native families experienced our traditional value of family being removed. We were told, you can't be parents. You can't raise kids. And that affects the whole community and the school environment for a teacher coming in from the outside, or if the teacher, even if they're like born and raised third generation of people from Alaska that aren't Native, it still affects them. And so that's part of this work, creates that healing space and leadership to where it also helps for the non-Native voice that's really wanting to do what's right and what's best to not feel the pressure to have to like go in and feel like I'm stepping on toes trying to fix something. Because the tribes are, in this case with the consortium, making that space, leading that conversation, having these acknowledgments, having our meetings set up in this way to where we're valuing everybody at the table, but still recognizing like, yes, this is tribally focused, but there's still space for you. Mm-hmm. And that's been, I think, one of the ways of embedding and taking like 11 months to figure out how do we set something up that's fundamentally and in our foundation documents allows for that to be carried out in practice. And we still have space to tweak that, but I think that's one of the things that's drawing people into this conversation and will have a really big impact on our state. So looking at the formation timeline, We started our first statewide Zoom meeting to really kick off after reflecting from February through April, like how are we going to do this, having some conversations in Washington, D.C. with our congressional delegates. Think we were in the midst of doing House Tribal Affairs hearing committees for compacting, so kind of putting all of that in real-time learning experience together. And then we started out the first meeting with the governance and structure and then scope discussions. And these were online. And then the next week, we looked at the, more of the detailed focus discussions. And it was really looking at how are we going to do this work technically now that we've kind of scoped out. And then how do we get more people who are at the table? One of the questions we asked is, who's missing from this conversation and how do we connect with them? And then we did an in-person meeting in Anchorage in April as well. April was a very busy month. That was an all-day meeting, technical working groups. We worked on the mission, vision, purpose, drafting that together. And then from August, we took a break for summer. Everyone recognized that fishing is not the time to get everyone together on Zoom. And so we did not fight that, and we all went fishing. And then we came back in August, and we started doing monthly ANTEC Zoom meetings. And this was the statewide Zoom outreach. The Department of Education helped with sending this out through the Alaska Native Education newsletter. That goes about 1,800 people across the state to do the outreach. And then we were also doing monthly meetings from September and into January, September 25 into January 2026, going to Washington, D.C., meeting with our congressional delegate offices for Alaska. We've also had conversations with Hawaii because they're also not part of the BIA, and looking at how did Hawaii do this, because the Hawaii has a model that's a little bit different. And so we read through the federal law and then talked to them like what worked, what didn't. They have one school district. We have over 50. They have one language that has dialects, but we have 22 official languages that are Alaska Native, or 23. So just like looking at similar differences. And then we met with the Secretary of Education a couple of times, once in the spring, once in the fall, to kind of temperature check. We're forming something new. How does this work with federal law from her understanding? What are the possible pathways and partnerships we could do with the U.S. Department of Education? We started these spring conversations when it was announced that the Department of Education was cutting half the staff and the goal was to get rid of it. And so one of the things is like we're coming to the table saying we want to start something new in education. And then it looks like the message is we're closing education. How do we work together at this? And so we've had very productive conversations. And one of the outcomes of the consortium's work is that the third strategic priority from the Secretary of Education for the U.S. Department of Education includes returning education to tribes. So that was one of the things that we were able to work on federally throughout this last year that got published in the Federal Registry. We've also been meeting with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There is the Stevens Rider, which removed the BIA from Alaska in 1986. And so looking at what does that look like? How do we engage with BIA and the Bureau of Indian Education? And then in December, as I mentioned previously, our constitution was empowered through tribal resolutions, and ANTEC became an officially a tribally sanctioned organization, legally on paper. And then in January, Ketchikan Indian Community agreed to be the fiscal agent for the consortium. And then our last slide for the kind of nuts and bolts piece, so this is the shout out. If you know of any tribes or NGOs that we've mentioned who would be eligible or interested, please have them reach out, and we can send them a draft template resolution for how to join, so they're not having to figure out all the from scratch legality of what they need to do. And we just want to express our thanks for the committee. One of the other things that came up in this process, some of our meetings, we start out our Zoom meetings where half of the meeting is everybody, the tribes, NGOs, and the LEAs or the education folks that come to the meeting. And then about halfway through, we shift into two breakout rooms. And one of the questions we ask the LEAs is, or the education partners, why are you here? Like, this is a tribal education consortium. What brought you to the table? And I think that was one of the things that really helped solidify we're doing the right work, because and that what the gaps and needs are. So it showed that, and we knew this before, but it's always great to hear it from people who are living it. They want to serve their students. They're looking for these resources. And especially something like a clearinghouse for curriculum. How do I better serve my students? How do I learn more about bringing language into the classroom? How do I support my administrator to support me better in carrying out the work in the classroom, but also help my administrator feel more confident in how to transform the school environment? So we were getting really good feedback from the educators who were attending. And then the other thing that throughout the meetings that we would ask is, how would you like us to outreach to you and make it clear when, like respectfully, when we need you to be in the room and when we need you to be out of the room for this kind of work to happen? And that we got good feedback on how to be very direct, and also the acknowledgments at the beginning of the meetings to make it clear that it's not meant to be rude or exclusive. We just want to make it very clear so you're not respectful of your time. If you know you only need to be here for half an hour, you only book a half hour of your time. And it's not that we are rejecting you. It's just that's what this meeting is for. And so that was one of the helpful pieces to just kind of continue to refine how we engage respectfully. If there's anything. And I'm going to, if I may, turn. Mark, is there anything you want to add for student success? Okay. If through the chair, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Okay. We have time. So, okay. Mark Roseberry, if you could come to the table and put your name on the record.
Through the chair, Mark Roseberry. I'm the director for education for the Inupiaq community of the Arctic Slope and the administrator for our Karagia Academy Tribal School. What we're seeing with our students, you know, our students come to us, what they experience in the school, a vast majority of them are bullied, and they come to us for a different opportunity. The students, because our environment's different, it's created more in line with the community, you don't see the students stressed in the same way as they were in the school. And they feel at home. It's a family environment. So if you imagine that, you're going to see interactions very much like a family. And you're going to see students smiling. And that stress, when you take away the stress, it changes the education. I will say this. A lot of the older students that we have come in, many of them are far behind in their proficiency levels. We see that in the state tests. We know that's happening. It's real. And so it takes time for our staff to work with them. And they work with them in a way that is a growth model. So take them from where they were very undisciplined in education or feeling like they weren't successful. And it takes time. They're not like overnight changing into the model student, but they are moving in that direction. And we see that growth. And through patience and time and our staff working, and we have all local staff, so they know the students, they know the families. And so when you see that, you see a vast majority of those students all in a growth model, not coming in and going the other way. They're all growing, and they're growing at different paces. We've seen just, you know, we have specialists that work with them now because we test them when they come in. If they're far behind in reading, writing, and math, it's very difficult to do your courses if you don't understand what you're reading and the words and everything. So we have specialists working with them. So we build that along with other things, and we see growth. Some of the students in a little bit of time got the grade level. Others are taking a little longer, but they're all moving in that direction at a pace that is exceeding what would be expected so that they can catch up. If they're only doing what's expected, then they stay at their level that they're behind. So we're working to exceed that.
Thank you for all of your work, and thank you for your words. We have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, what is the size of your school community?
So we have two physical sites. One's in Wainwright. One is in Utqiagvik. And then we have homeschool students that we serve. We have a total of 44 students right now. We have about 15 in Utqiagvik, and then we have about 12 in Wainwright, and then the others are homeschooled.
Thank you.
All right. Well, sure. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Dr. Isaac and all, I just wanted to say thank you for coming and, you know, considering the opportunities to bring people together. I know we've had quite a few conversations on that topic, and this opportunity I think is one of the most transformative opportunities for parents across Alaska, because we do have a disconnect in a lot of especially small rural communities, and it's where I'm from, but maybe it exists entirely in some of the largest districts as well. I'm not as familiar with, but this opportunity to engage families in the quality and the importance of education, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how the consortium can balance the two sides of education in Alaska, and that is a culturally relevant experience, but also on a global scale, because every one of our tribal children are shareholders in multi-million dollar or billion dollar companies. And it is extremely important for these individual children to be able to graduate from high school and step into a global economy and succeed. So I just wanted to put that on the table. And then just kind of a little final, I had to laugh when you noted coming up with a meeting date. And I think you might struggle as you grow your organization. A lot like my husband and I had a hard time finding a date to get married, because in fall there's hunting season, and in winter there's trapping season, and in summer there's fishing season. So we got married in March. So August, interior caribou hunting and berry picking. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Actually, I was married in March as well. It's a quiet time.
Interior.
Dr. Isaac, engaging families and small communities. Thank you.
Just Joel Isaac for the record into the chair and wrap up. That really, I think you hit the nail on the head, is we're looking at something that's additive. And when we have meetings, we've had to do the technical piece. How do we do the legal work? How do we make sure we follow the rules that are in federal and state laws? But we want to make sure that those voices aren't excluded from the table just because it's like, oh, we have a voting meeting, so you can't come. And that's, again, why we go to the working group. And we've invited people to come who said, like, well, I'm not an official representative for my tribe, but I'm a teacher. Or I work with my kids doing language. And it's like, you should come. Like, your voice matters in this work. And you don't have to be only a voting member to be able to attend a work group or a planning meeting in this way. And then the other piece with it is, it's not like we want culture or education. It's together. And thinking about why we would have to sacrifice learning an Alaska Native language and not learning to read. And it's like, well, we should be able to do both. And that gets us to the shared goals. It's not the hierarchy of like, oh, this entity or this group of people's goals are this and ours are this and one's better than the other. It's like, we can achieve both of these. And the example that you listed, Representative Schwanke, I think is a great one for, it's like, we want our kids to be able to read, do math, be able to function on the land, learn language. And we're looking at, like, how do we make that change? And that really is, I think, that you see throughout the slides, that driving conundrum. And the answer is that everyone has to work together and recognize that it's both shared goals is the outcome, not one or the other. And then it works. And so I just wanted to appreciate everyone's time in the committee. And our contact information for the co-facilitators.
Thank you. We have one more question from Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, and I guess my question is, I feel like I'm playing catch up in many ways on this, so I apologize for my maybe very basic questions. In your mission statement earlier, so I'm going back a little bit, the mission here is to uphold and advance tribal sovereignty and education. And some of your slides after that are really establishing tribal sovereignty, that exists. It's I think, very strong. What needs to be advanced in this area? Because that word, I think, is very specific. And I guess, what is the barrier that you see to tribal education existing? I think, Mr. Roseberry, I think that was what you said your name was. Thank you. It's nice to meet you. You know, it sounds like you have a school that's operating maybe in a sovereign way? And so I'm trying to understand what's missing. If there's a sense that something needs to be advanced or changed, is there a barrier to establishing tribal education? And if so, what is that barrier?
Mark Roseberry, through the chair. That's a great question. What our challenge is, I am constantly out fundraising. That's how we keep it. We started with our tribe received discretionary funds, and our tribe is one of the two regional tribes in the state of Alaska. Tlingit Haida is the other. And our tribe covers around 94,000 square miles. It's a little bit bigger than the North Slope Borough. But the challenge is funding. We don't have a stable form of funding. And so I am deeply at like bare bones funding. Even with that, you know, we have people dedicated. We even had some people that were volunteered when we couldn't pay them. Our secretary volunteered for a while to continue the work. So we don't have stable funding. The federal government, through the Stevens Writer, as Dr. Isaac mentioned, blocks BIE funding from coming to the state of Alaska and all that. That's a long story on why that happened. We are working with the federal government now to fulfill their trust obligations, but there isn't a mechanism at this point in time other than tribal compacting and then grants that are given that can't really be used for operations. That's a challenge. I can get funding for special projects, but for operations, there isn't a steady flow. So I'm out there either with our local municipalities, other entities that will be like ConocoPhillips that donate. That's how we're operating, and it's usually month to month, just making sure. I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to get down here, and we were working on that because we were short of funding, and then we found some to come. That's how tight it is.
If I may add to that, Joel Isaac, for the record, through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I think the beginning presentation of like the federal state law pieces, what Mark mentioned with the Stevens Writer, what happened with that in the 80s is Congress used their plenary power to say our federal trust responsibility, which is includes funding, was being transferred to the state of Alaska. And that transfer is not the completely correct legal term. There's not like one word kind of answer to that. But Congress used its authority to say the state of Alaska is going to meet the educational needs of tribal citizens that the federal government's responsible to do. Because the state of Alaska's constitution says there's one system of education in Alaska. And it was determined in that decade that having the BIA and DEED happening in Alaska at the same time was two separate systems of education. And that Alaska said there was, the constitution said there was one system. So Congress's solution was you as the state deal with it. And the tribes are like, well, there's a federal trust responsibility. And when it was transferred to the state, there's no legal mechanism for tribes to receive operational funding in our state. And that's why the compacting conversation is a vehicle for that to address in state law. How do tribes access state public education dollars? Because the federal government said the state and the state said, we're going to do this. And then it never happened. And so that's the situation that we're in, is that there's no legal way for the state of Alaska to give operational money right now that with the way the Education is Foundation formula funded. There's not the Department of Education DEED does not have like a block grant that they can say, oh, yeah, we're going to use DEED money to fund education. It's not appropriated that way. And that's one of the differences between like the Indian Health Service compacts, which is the federal government being in our state doing health care, and then compacting came in, and it's a transfer for those services from the federal government operating them, and now the funds come from the feds to the tribes to operate health care. Because the federal government's not operating education in Alaska, the federal government cannot transfer those services to tribes. It has to come from the state to the tribes. And that's kind of, I think, the easiest way to show those parallels is IHS, what I just mentioned, with the current state laws.
Thank you. Just a follow-up, if I may?
Follow-up, Representative okay. Ruffridge.
So, and that's really helpful. Thank you. That really, I think, clears up quite a bit. I guess from your perspective, you know, potentially the sovereignty piece is not the baseline here for the mission. It is establishing because the mission is advanced tribal sovereignty in education, but I feel like there's a piece missing here, and that is how do you fund it? And I appreciate that sort of coming, because that really wasn't anywhere in this conversation, and it really comes down to who is paying for it. And so I guess, how do you envision that payment model working? Would it be a separate formula for tribal education? I guess, what is the mission for, and maybe you haven't talked about this because ANTEC is new, but what do you envision that funding piece looking like that would empower this?
That's a great question.
Yes. Dr. Joel Isaac.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Ruffridge. For the consortium operating, we have been working with our federal delegates to look at what does federal funding look like to staff the consortium. And that does not solve the operational questions that we just discussed, but it's kind of like they're braided conversations. So if we think funding for the consortium, we're looking at what does the federal appropriation look like, and then doing like fees for service so someone could contract with the consortium. So there's that piece of the consortium. To actually carry out and operate schools, the consortium, one of the things that we've discussed, it is not the intent of the consortium to operate a school. That's part of the amplifying the tribal sovereignty. How do we advocate for the funding to go directly to the tribe rather than going through a consortium, it getting skimmed, and then going to a tribe? We don't want to do any form of that skimming process, for good or bad. That's not the intent. And that's what we're looking for, and what the consortium would be advocating for is something like tribal compacting, where the funding flows directly from the state to a tribe, or some mechanism from a federal source to a tribal source. And that's really that advocacy piece, is how do we advocate to make that happen? Because we don't want the consortium to infringe on a tribe's funding to go to their school. And so that's really the core. One of those other core statements that we've had in the meetings is ANTEC is not a competition for a tribal school. We're here for like the support around it, not the operation of it. And so that's why we need something, we being the tribes in the state, need something like tribal compacting to happen in order for tribes to receive what is legally, or arguably what is legally entitled through trust responsibility, is public education dollars. Currently, a tribe is not stopped from using whatever ways it can fundraise. Mark talked about it. The tribes have figured out how to either do grant, endowment, philanthropic, to make a school happen. That doesn't stop it, but it also doesn't, you spend all your time fundraising, and then there's no guarantee, as Mark said. So that's really the funding fix, is we need something that's reoccurring, dependable operational funds to meet that responsibility.
Thank you, Dr. Joel Isaac, and we are at our time right now. I really appreciate all of your hard work the past 11 months. It seems like we might need to have further discussions on this, so I look forward to those. And my staff, Almaria, if anyone else has other questions, we can work with you and Dr. Isaac to get those answered. And with that, I just thank you so much for your presentation. As a longtime educator who also wrote curriculum that intertwined Indigenous knowledge, it's very important for healing in Alaska, and I do appreciate that slide on that and just your work. And with that, thank you, Anabasi, so much. Thank you, Mr. Roseberry. And we're going to take a brief at ease as we prepare for our final presentation. Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Good morning, everyone. I would like to give a warm welcome to President Justina Wilhelm and External Affairs Coordinator Frida Nagyak from Ilisagvik College. Hello, welcome. Please state your names and titles for the record and begin your presentation.
All right. Queen Akbuk, thank you through the chair. My name is Justina Wilhelm, and I am president of Elise Ugbeek College.
Through the chair, my name is Frida Nagak. I'm the external affairs coordinator for Elise Ugbeek.
So, Uvla Lotak, Paglagifsi, Uvanga Justina, Inupak Siniga Avu, Utkiagbing Mugurunga, Sabaktunga, Elise Ugbeek College, me, Angayukaka, Mori, and Rosanna Limanlu, and Simeon and Loretta Kunaknanalu. I said good morning. Greetings. My name is Justina. My Inupak name is Avu. I come from Utkiagbing, and I work at Elise Ugbeek College. My parents are Mori and Rosanna Liman. And my in-laws are Loretta and Simeon Kunaknana.
For the record, Frida, Uvanga Tihluk, Toniksingina Frida, Ukarving Mirunga, Savaktunga Elisarving Mi, Asi Norsup Boros School District Board Member. So I said my name is Tihluk, my English name is Frida. I work at Elisarving College. I am also our school district's board member.
Thank you. Justina Waham for the record through the chair. So we have a general presentation of Elise Ugbeek College, providing some general information, some statistics, and a look ahead of where we're at. Really excited this year. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary of Elise Ugbeek. So please feel free to ask any questions as I go through this presentation. So moving first, we want to just acknowledge the land that we come from up on the north slope of the Inupiaq. We honor the people, the culture, the animals, land, and ocean. There is one little typo there. I'll let you find it, but apologies for that. we want to acknowledge the land that we're here on, here in the southeast, the Linkit-Ani, Tlingit peoples, as the original stewards of this land we are visiting. Very exciting to see mountains. We woke up and was like, whoa, compared to our flat area. I had to take a picture for my kids. Our vision, we're here to help build strong communities through education and training. This picture is our student government association that we have currently on our campus. And our mission is to provide quality post-secondary academic and vocational and technical education in a learning environment that, so happy to share that we could embed our Inupiaq culture, language, values, and traditions in all things that we do so that we could work to grow a well-educated, trained workforce, not just for the North Slope, but Alaska and beyond. A little history about Elise Ugbeek and our physical location. If you haven't been to Utqiagvik, we're 2.5 miles out from town, and we're currently occupying an old naval infrastructure. There's about 15 facilities, and some of our science labs and our classrooms are in Quonset huts, and we have water that fills our tanks and sewage trucks that come and take our sewage from us still. So we're thankful for the facilities that we have, but very excited to be moving forward. Looking to some of our history of who we are, we were once upon a time part of the University of Alaska Fairbanks system and various iterations through the North Slope Borough, Inupiaq University of the Arctic, North Slope Higher Education Consortium. Our prior mayor, George Amawak, was very focused on workforce development, where he initiated the Mayor's Workforce Development Center, and hitting our official 30th, 1996, as becoming an accredited tribal college through the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities. And in 2005, we became a tribally controlled and chartered tribal college. We are sanctioned by the Inupiaq community of the Arctic Slope, and we're currently Alaska's only tribal college. History this year, we've been very busy with a land acquisition of 15 acres. We're purchasing land from Ukpiagvik Inupiaq Corporation to build our new campus that will be centrally located in town right next to the Samuel Simmons Hospital, where our land development is growing in that direction. And then as 2026, we are turning 30, so very excited about that. You've heard a little bit this morning from our previous presenters, ANTEC, with their consortium. And Ilisagavik is currently part of the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. So we're part of a consortium of 37 tribal colleges all throughout the United States. It's a very valuable group to be amongst, sister tribal colleges that are grounded with the cultural and holistic view of serving students, and we're able to meet with them in a variety throughout the year. We will be leaving next week to D.C. for the legislative summit, where Frida and I will be have two students joining us as we go meet with our state contacts, as well as with our other tribal colleges and universities. So what does it mean to be a tribal college? So there are some requirements that we need to maintain. As mentioned, we are tribally chartered by the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope. We need to maintain a 51% Alaska Native American enrollment. We're currently at a healthy 63% with our population right now. And the majority of our board needs to be Alaska Native or American Indian. We currently have 12 board of trustees, which is 8 of our North Slope communities, an at-large seat, and we have 3 seats that are dedicated, one for our tribe, ICAS, the second for the school district to prioritize pre-college programming and communications, as well as the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and an at-large seat. A little bit about our funding. We receive 2/3 of our funding from the North Slope Borough. As dated 1996, we are, through the municipal code, a subset of the North Slope Borough government. And then 1/3 of our funding comes from various state, federal, local, private donors. We do our due diligence to identify other sources of funding as well.
Justina, I have a question, then we'll go to Representative Carrick. Can you share with us if federal cuts have affected Ilisagavik College?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. We, thankfully, with AHEC, have been monitoring on the ground in D.C. some of the various cuts. As of now, thankfully, there have been no impacts. Some of our current funding is forward funding, so even if there was to be a government shutdown or funding that would take place, we are okay right now. It's a constantly moving target with all of the federal movements, with the Department of Education moving. All of the colleges will be moving under Department of Labor, but tribal colleges will be going under the Department of Interior. So it's very unknown. We're waiting to have more information of what that looks like and how that funding would look like.
Thank you, President. Representative Carrick.
Thank you. I just want to start by saying thank you so much for being here. And I've actually had the opportunity to stay at and participate in a few activities at Ilisagavik, and I really love the campus, and I really appreciate you all being here. I was curious. I see on this slide 1/3 of the funding comes from state and federal grants. I was wondering what, do you have funding that is passed through the University of Alaska system? And then I know through the Technical Vocation Education Program, some of that funding for that kind of training comes through the state. But can you break down a little bit further what some of the pass-through funding from the state looks like, and then if you have it from the university looks like?
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Carrick, for your question. So currently for the state, we have 2 funding sources, which is, one is the TVEP funding that we receive, and there's currently 10 recipients who receive TVEP funding, and there's a various breakdown of the percentages of those TVEP and how much those entities get. We only receive 3%. The UA system receives 45%. There's varies 3%, 7%, and I believe that needs to be approved through a bill. So, putting a plug in there. If we have a slide later that will show you some statistics, but we would really very much advocate for a higher number than 3% for that funding. And the only other funding from the state is a pass-through grant through the federal government for our internet at our Tuzzy Library. We operate a public and college library, Tuzzy Consortium, and we receive funding for our internet. So those are the two current fundings that we receive through the state. As for the University of Alaska system, there are no pass-through funds that we receive. We are an independent public college and are not connected in any way to the university system. However, we have many partnerships and articulation agreements with our Alaskan colleges for articulation agreements and pathways for our students to pursue.
Thank you. I guess just one quick follow-up.
So follow-up.
Very recently, the last time TVAP was reauthorized, the sunset date was just taken out of it. So unless the legislature takes it up as a special item of business, it's not something that will come up for reauthorization now. But thank you for the advocacy on that. And I just one quick follow-up question on the UA. Do you have any it's okay if you don't off the top of your head, but any examples of the partnership work that's happening there?
Through the chair. Thank you. Representative Carrick, I have a slide for that, if you want me to get to that.
We'll hold off.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go.
All right. So through the chair, Justina Wilhelm, I'll continue forward. Some institutional attributes and partnerships. So again, we are accredited through the Northwest Commission and Colleges and Universities, same accreditation as the UA system. That's our Western accrediting body through the United States. All of our academic programming could be completed via distance. We have students from statewide as well as students from all I've signed acceptance letters from Tennessee, California, Nebraska. We have students that are part of our Ilisagavigmut. We have $205 is a credit hour per credit hour, so pretty cost effective for our students. And tuition waivers. So our North Soap Borough Mayor provides a generous contribution for our all North Soap residents, native or non-native, to pursue college at Ilisagavik, as well as we offer a Alaska Native Native American tuition waiver for all. So partnerships through the Northwest Commission, we have just recently added the Aleut community of St. Paul Tribal Government as an instructional site. We've had a long-standing relationship with the Aleut community of St. Paul, so happy that we're moving forward to that. They currently have some Unungan Tunu classes as well as wanting to grow some of their workforce trainings that we bring to their island. Speaking to the university system, we recently signed a MOA with the University of Alaska Southeast for a health information management track and supports for our University of Alaska Fairbanks. We have an Ilisari Gupta program. We closely work with the North Soap Borough School District to grow our own teachers so our students could pursue beginning at the college at Ilisagavik with their AA and then move on to the University of Alaska for their BA degree, all while staying at home in their home communities. So really excited about that. For the University of Alaska Anchorage, we have an early childhood education program track that we work with them for. And for the Alaska Pacific University, we work with our pre-nursing certificate through our AA program that will feed into their four-year nursing program. So again, very large state, very important that we work along all of our higher ed partners. Speaking to the pre-college programming, we also have not just with our school district on the North Soap, but we have dual credit programming with the Annette Island in Metlakatla. We recently began a MOA with Mount Edgecombe this semester, offering dual credit for their Inupiaq Studies language classes, and then working with our Northern Industrial Training, NIT, for the workforce trainings. It's a very high demand up in the North Soap, so working with additional contractors to come up to help fill those needs so we can continue offering those classes. Moving forward, we are lifelong learners. We're always constantly learning and growing, and you can never grow too much. So really focusing on our pre-college programming. We have an amazing recruiting team that works with our elementary age students, our middle school students. We have a robust summer camp program. We just approved 11 summer camps that will be taking place this summer. Through generous grants and donations, we are able to open that up statewide. We provide airfare, lodging, room, board, so our students could receive a college experience to get that taste of what college looks like, so that they're ready when they graduate, they can have college on their mind, and hopefully at least Algamik, if not others. But we're very happy for that. And moving to the high school, some of those summer camps have dual credit opportunities, as well as our general dual credit opportunities that we have. And moving on, we do have our programs that I'll share in a different slide, but there are people who may not want to pursue a degree or a specific certificate. They want to go straight to the workforce, and there's specific certifications and trainings that are very much critical for them to perform their job duties. So we work with various entities to provide short-term trainings, as well as a lot of residents who choose to just take a skin sewing class, or I want to make a soapstone kulik class. So we have a lot of our residents who may just want to continue to learn and have those cultural opportunities that take classes. I can think of an elder who has taken a skin sewing class, I think, 4 times because she loved it so much. So having that flexibility to embed our culture is just amazing.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, just a quick question on this slide, which is, it's, I guess, maybe could you describe what, are you doing work inside elementary school, middle school, and high school sort of as pre-preparation or, I guess, recruitment? I thought that's maybe what you were saying, but I was just wondering if you could describe that a little bit more. Thanks.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. To answer your question, I would say all of the above. So working within the schools, bringing students to campus to have different experiences. We have middle school glimpse programming where they can come after school to learn. Our extension programming has kids in the kitchen, yoga, various community workshops on the weekends. We're very present statewide at various school conferences. We have booths for recruiting. We love our First Alaska FAI Elders and Youth Conference. This past year, we held 2 workshops and 1 lunch and learn, as well as our booths to make sure that we're our reach is as far as much as we could help recruit and share about Elise Algovic.
Please go on. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I will continue on. About our programs and the degrees that we offer 1 bachelor's degree in business administration, 11 associate degrees, and 25 certificates, various certificates that also include endorsements as well. I won't go line by line, but this is an overview of our 24-25 enrollment of our students. We almost had 1,000 students this past year. 3 students graduated from their BAs and all of the different certificates and degrees. 60% of our student population is age 25 and over, and we are working to grow that 18 to 25-year-old pathway. The last statistic, I believe last year, was of 70%. So that decrease is a positive for me to know that we're reaching our younger generation of students to pursue college. A lot of first-generation college students that are entering our doors are not familiar with college settings, and we have a wonderful student services team that works with them on first-year pathway, programs, supports, onboarding, and a lot of that is not even education-related. It's family, homesick, maybe there's a funeral and they need to go back home to be with their families. What are we doing as an institution to be accommodating to support our students, but at the same time support our students in other ways so that they could focus on their education pathways?
President Wilhelm, we have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. Welcome. both of you. Glad you're here today. I was looking on slide 8 where you have a partnership with Northern Industrial Training, and I was wondering of the 35 certificates, the endorsements, if you could break that down a little bit about what was popular, anything through that partnership to meet your job training needs in your area.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Story, Justina Wilhelm, for the record. We have a slide for that as well. But off the top of my head, the majority of the needs for NIT is CDL, HEO, heavy equipment operations. Those are high demand for our area, for keeping our power and lights on, for clearing our roads. It's a constant need. Something really happy that I'm proud to share for Ilhi Sagavik is we became a state-approved driving school through the state of Alaska, so that we're able to provide not only CDL and driver's license, but real IDs, permits, those important identification pieces that our residents need to travel, to apply for work.
Thank you.
And we have a question from Representative Carrick.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. I was just curious on the enrollment slide, if the almost 1,000 students, has that been kind of the average enrollment over the last, say, 5 to 10 years of your mm-hmm. history, and or is enrollment increasing over time?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Carrick, Justina Wilhelm, for the record. That dropped this past year. So we usually typically are around 1,100 to 1,200 students. So it was clearly a drop. We looked at why did we have this drop, and something as small as starting a week earlier than the school district really impacted some of our dual credit students. So we've had some turnover on our staff. Living in a rural environment is the reality of filling positions from instructors to administrative positions have been a barrier for us. So those are some of the areas, items that we've seen this drop in enrollment. But just looking at this past fall 25, we've already seen an increase. So we're hopeful that will continue on with those enrollment numbers.
Please continue. Oh, we have one more question from Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciated hearing about Northern Industrial Training. I'm assuming the other certificates are the majority. I know you had a dental program on one of your slides. If you could just tell me about your health endorsements and the other ones that you are giving opportunities for to the people.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Story, Justina Wilhelm, for the record. So this slide covers our programs that we offer. And within these programs, you could receive a certificate one, like accounting certificate one, and then a two that will build to a AA degree. Same for allied health or our education programming. So being a tribal college and also something we want to continue to do to accommodate our seasonal lifestyle is looking more towards stacked courses or shorter 8-week classes so that our residents could start and stop at fresh times is something that we're moving towards as we look at future calendar operations. Mm-hmm. Some of those other certificates, all of our HEO heavy equipment operations and our construction trades pathways also build with certificates, and all of our HEO, you receive college certificates, but you also receive the NCCER nation certificates that are approved. So we are an NCCER certified site as well for our construction trades technology instructors.
Thank you, President. And I'm looking at the time. We have about 10 more minutes and about 10 slides.
Okay.
So I think we'll save questions for time at the end this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Anna Bossi.
Thanks. Through the chair, again, Justina Wilhelm, I'll just continue with our indigenization efforts, our strategic priority one, being a tribal college. Our foundation is on indigenizing all things Ilhi Sagavik. We recognize that we live in a diverse state, a diverse community. Our staff, our students, we're very diverse. But if a student or an employee is going to elect to work or attend Ilhi Sagavik, they are going to experience an Inupiaq experience. but that does not take away their own personal ethnicities. We're inclusive to all. We want to make everybody feel welcome. We have students from Emonik, Elam, Chugiak. This semester, we've had a record-breaking 31 dorm students in the fall, finished up with 29, a strong number. So making sure that we're inclusive to all who choose to be at Ilis Agavik. And quickly, this is just some of our employee opportunities where we give the gift of our culture, and we're intentional with providing field trips or attending cultural activities, but not just pushing our employees to go be somewhere. Come be with us, sit with us, and we'll show you and share our culture. Also to our students, just they get homesick, and if you put a pot of caribou soup in the residential kitchen area and you get that whiff across the hall, I swear that cures homesickness. So having that ability to be able to have our own cultural freezer or to have activities. These are our Innu Fine Arts Festivals that we have every spring and fall that our Inupiat faculty lead. So again, just emphasizing on indigenization is very key as a tribal college. Some of our TVEP numbers. So this has the 10 institutions that received TVEP. Just wanted to highlight that Ilis Agavik College was the highest percentage of employment for the first year exit. For what the first one to 12 months, as well as the first 1 to 12 months after exit. So those two categories, columns in the first, Ilis Agavik is leading those with the percentages.
Okay, we have a quick question from Representative Kirk. Okay.
Just thank you through the chair. Just a very quick comment that this chart is not reflective of the most recent reauthorization of TVEP, and so. It now includes a couple of new recipients and a couple of changed percentages. I just wanted to note that. But otherwise, it's essentially accurate in general.
Okay. Through the chair. Thank you, yes. Representative Carrick, for that. This is the most recent TVEP report that we have, and that was online and available to us. Thank you. And just speaking to some of the variety of workforce trainings that are requested and that we provide to our community. This is not everything, but the high level of what it is, from a blend of soft skills, office management, to CPR, first aid services. I'll skip through these photos. And this is our data. So our institutional research data that Ilis Agavik maintains. The full report is on our website if you want to do some more data review. But this is a 5-year review of the various workforce data trainings, data that we have provided. So looking to 2024-25, we provided a number of 169 individual trainings. And of those 169 trainings, 118 of those were scheduled, and 51 of those were requested by specific entities per their request of what is needed. So a high completion rate of 96%, and I won't go in detail due to time. CDL. Licenses and classes, Representative Story, you were inquiring about some of the high asks. This is definitely one of the high asks that we provide to our residents. Totaling, we served 134 participants this past year with various behind the wheel general knowledge. We do what we can up on the slope, but we do have to bring our students down to an official 2-lane highway where they could drive a certain speed limit and do crossing and intersections. So they remain here for 2 weeks if it's Fairbanks, Wasilla, or Anchorage are areas that we bring our students to. And on the horizon, looking ahead, I shared we are pursuing a new college campus. That's a pretty hefty price tag living in the North Slope and the cost that it takes to do a stick build piling campus. But we're not going to lose sight. We're going to continue to move forward with this process. Our current process is we are purchasing the land. We've just completed an environmental assessment of this land. And we were, the pictures in this slide, we have a, we went through a design competition in 2018. And since it has been some time, we will be reviewing this to meet, we've had COVID, we've had enrollment numbers that need to be revisited. So we're happy we have a design. We're hoping to look at it to maybe do some cost saving, but very excited. This is broken down into three phases of our new campus. We also are looking at 105L leasing, and we've had some congressional direct funds from Senator Murkowski that we have set aside. Some of our unmet needs for our Ilya Salkovic, as mentioned, our new campus, our heavy equipment is in need of a Class A truck to provide those CDL trainings. And on the academic and student services front, looking to fill some funding for future positions to grow. Science is very important in our state and our region. Being placed in the Arctic, there's a lot of science opportunities and collaboration and partnerships. So we are looking to grow our science programming degrees. Also, data is very important to share and advocate for our story. So having an assessment coordinator and the student supports for cultural specialists, as well as our outreach and programming. Wrapping up, this is our other final unmet needs slides, research and for our students. So focusing on some of our student research opportunities that we currently work on, we have some Arctic tundra research that our faculty works with our students. And then also having some funding set aside for our students to travel to various conferences to share their storyboards, as well as to be amongst other students and learn and have that opportunity with their science work that they're doing. Internet is a big thing. We had 9 months of an ice scouring event. We do the best we can with our internet connectivity. It's very it varies through our community. Some have fiber, some don't have fiber. Bandwidth is an issue. But we do work to provide our students internet stipends. As well, it's not noted here, but we also provide loaner laptops to our students with 6 credits or more. So providing those supporting academic supports will help them be successful with their education. But, I see it's 9:58, and I know I was jumping through, so if External Affairs, Nagak, if there's anything you want to add real brief.
Through the chair, Frida Nagak, for the record, I just wanted to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to present. And so I have a lot of work experience, but I don't have a degree. So I'm currently an Ilya Salkovic student working on my AA in business management. And my dream was always to be a nurse. And so through Ilya Salkovic pre-nursing program and through Samuel Simmons, hopefully one day I'll be able to complete my nursing degree at home. So it's really, Ilya Salkovic has really embraced the culture. I worked for a lot of different Native corporations throughout the state. And so this is the first entity that really, truly embraces the culture. And it's the number one, you know, embracing the culture, making sure language classes are free for the region and for the people. So I just wanted to add that. So thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing your story and best of luck. We have a comment or question from Representative Freer.
Thank you so much, through the chair, President Wilhelm and Frida. Thank you guys so much for being here. I'm so happy we were able to get you in front of Tribal Affairs. Ilya Salkovic is home for me. My Aka was an assistant professor of Inupiaq studies and helped build a curriculum for that program throughout my childhood. And I grew up in the halls of Ilya Salkovic, going to the Christmas parties and going to Tuzzy Library after school. And I'm just so happy that you guys are here. I also previously served as the executive director of human resources for Ilya Salkovic College, and I was on the Ilya Salkovic College Board of Trustees as the North Slope Borough School District. And so everything that you guys are doing is all near and dear to my heart. I'm so happy to get that you had the opportunity to share that with everybody else. You guys are doing amazing things, and I'm so happy to celebrate Ilya Salkovic's 30th birthday. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, I want to go to the birthday party, if there is a birthday party. Maybe our whole committee.
You're all invited. We'd be happy to have you.
Wonderful. Yeah, maybe virtually. any more questions or comments from our guests from Utviagvik? Okay, well, Anna Bossi, thank you so much for your presentation and just sharing your beautiful work and campus way up in the north. And a huge congratulations. I heard that the sun came back to your community this last week, and that must be really a beautiful thing. And and anything we can do, our committee or my office, please don't hesitate to reach out. And with that, thank you for your presentation. It is 10:01, 1 minute over. This Tribal Affairs Committee's ended. Thanks.